Hello and welcome to USSO Cast, a US Studies online podcast. In this series, I chat to PhDs and ECRs about their research, their life in academia, and all things in between. Today, I'm joined by Danny Bowman, a third-year PhD student at the University of Sheffield, whose research looks at animals, human and non-human, in American automotive culture. So Danny, welcome. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, thanks. Yeah, how's it going?
Excellent. Yeah, not bad. Thank you for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Firstly, before we get into your research, I mean, how are you getting on in your kind of year as we edge ever closer to summer? Are you kind of winding down now, or are things really ramped up work-wise? Because that's how it feels for me.
Things are reaching a bit of a crescendo in some ways. I mean, I'm teaching my first module this semester as well. And we're just getting to the stage where, you know, I'm doing like student consultations, doing marking for the first time.
Yeah.
Which getting to grips with that is very difficult. But the PhD work is kind of helped me actually, because I was at a bit of a loose end before that, like getting a bit lost in the lockdown PhD. Kind of the only thing I had on my mind was the thesis, but having a bit of a distraction from that and having to like put separate days aside to just work on that.
Yeah.
Has actually been really helpful.
I really empathize with that actually. There's so many points across the PhD kind of journey, you know, the last 3 years where you get kind of cabin fever when you do the same thing over and over again, and you're kind of looking to make more work for yourself so that you have things to distract you. And teaching, you know, I've only taught one module and I marked one set of module work. And that was, you know, 14 months ago or so now. It feels a lifetime ago. But it was a nice distraction and kind of, yeah, made the thesis feel a little bit more discreet. I mean, what's the module you're teaching? You maybe talk about that.
It's modern literature. So
that's pretty, it's a broad church.
It's like everything from, you know, like Irish, American, British modernist texts from 1900 to 1940 basically, but we got about a month's notice that we were going to be teaching this, and I think I'd read one of the books.
That was kind of a like learning on the job kind of thing.
100%, but yeah, in a really kind of in a very sort of big-headed way, it was quite nice to come back to it, because I was teaching third years and I was basically like really worried that I was going to get shown up, and it doesn't reflect on them at all, but I've kind of found it's been okay doing it week to week. So yes.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt, because when I taught, there were a lot of books that I'd never read before or only really knew kind of in a roundabout way. And then, you know, you're going into a room expecting to be the expert on them. It's like, what if these students are making points that are just like, I never even thought of. And I'm like, I don't know how to respond to this. I remember we did The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and someone just brought up a point about the ending that I just hadn't considered at all, which is obviously what you want. That's like amazing. It was just so good for discussion. But like, I couldn't just warrant it with the response it deserved, because I was like, man, I do not know Huckleberry Finn like I thought I did. And it's really great to hear about your teaching that's going well. Do you want to tell us about your PhD research, and feel free to go into as much detail as you'd like here?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so basically, it's called Horsepower, Animals in Automotive Culture, 1895 to 1935. Although certainly the end date of that is quite arbitrary at the moment.
Basically
it's kind of about the time in American society as seen through literature when society is moving from the horse as the main form of transportation power to the automobile. And I was just kind of looking at that period and thinking, what did we lose? What did we gain? And how, you know, from this kind of change in, how society was run basically from animal to machine. And how did this impact on human ideas of, well, humans, I suppose, so like as distinct from other animals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in my first chapter I kind of look a little bit at Upton Sinclair and his kind of his novels The Jungle and Oil, which take us basically, I mean, The Jungle is like a kind of a really horrible like harrowing story about basically the meat industry in Chicago, and the slaughterhouses around that time. And then Oil, his later novel, is kind of about about the automobile and oil culture, and about how these kind of things basically play off each other. And in the second chapter, I'm looking at the kind of beginnings of the road narrative in American culture, and kind of where do animals fit into that. And in what ways are you know, cars and animals kind of dematerialized, and why, you know, what's that covering up, basically. Yeah, in the third chapter, I'm looking at the impact of World War One, and how the horse's kind of image really takes a bit of a change.
Yeah.
At this point, as you know, war, it becomes harder to see it as like a glorious thing, basically. And then the chapter I'm currently writing and I've just finished a draft on is about kind of the how the automobile becomes really associated with national identity, and kind of which communities are excluded by being animalized kind of as a result of that.
That's brilliant. I mean, it's so fascinating because I remember when you first contacted me and I kind of met you on Twitter and stuff, and I just hadn't come across research that was doing really anything like this specifically. So it's really fascinating to hear more about it. Weirdly, I think there's a few overlaps with the stuff I look at as well. The period you're looking at is very similar to what I'm looking at in terms of that transition into automobile culture becoming the dominant mode of transport. And obviously, one thing I'm looking at is how, I guess, American geography was suddenly compressed massively. When you have a car, you can get to places, you know, that would have normally taken days and hours. And I mean, is community an important thing in your work? Are you looking at specific communities and how they are affected by changing automobile culture? Or are you looking more macro national kind of level, I guess?
Well, I mean, as always, inevitably, a little bit of both. But So there's a study that I've been looking at quite a lot, which kind of, there's already a lot of automotive history that kind of focuses on the impact on like separate communities, and you know, looking at like specifically how, like you say, basically how these kind of very isolated rural communities were suddenly kind of opened up a little bit.
Yeah. To,
you know, and you have a lot of people kind of moving out into the rural countries and linking up places that wouldn't normally be linked, basically. But no, I mean, what I'm really trying to identify is in all of these kind of, I guess they're not really like exclusively like what you'd think of as like road narratives or automotive texts, but basically I'm just trying to look for, look for basically the presence or absence of animals in these texts and what that kind of tells us about, you know, their importance, in the kind of growing technological society, basically.
I mean, one thing I wanted to kind of pick at a little bit is because, just for my own selfish reasons, I'm really interested in road narratives and road stories. I mean, that's something that continues well beyond my, you know, the period we're looking at. You know, road narratives are still so big. I mean, you just look at Nomadland, that's just won at the Oscars. Yeah, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's a road narrative amongst many other things. I just wonder if you could speak a bit more about how you kind of decided on that as an interesting narrative form to look at. And I know some of the text you look at, you mentioned Theodore Dreiser. I never know how to say his surname. Is it Dreiser? Is that how you would say it?
I think so. But again, I think I've only ever read it. So.
Yeah, this is a podcast where we butcher the names of American greats. I've read a little bit of A Hoosier's Holiday because that's the one where he kind of goes on a road trip with an associate, I can't remember who.
Franklin Booth.
That's the one. And he's basically just, he really turns against small town America in obviously what I look at, because he's suddenly saying, you know, look at all these places we can leave behind now we have a car.
It's such an amazing book that I mean, I don't get anywhere near doing it justice, because I mean, like, I'm not that I'm coming this from an amazingly narrow scope, but I mean, I'm just really trying to like focus on kind of their interactions between the car and the animals in it. But I mean, yeah, when I was reading the book, I was like, there's, you know, there's a whole PhD just on this, basically. But no, I mean, as I say, so road narratives specifically only kind of constitute one chapter of what I'm looking at. But it's really interesting just because, basically, one of the periodicals that I'm focusing on throughout every chapter that kind of links the whole PhD together, and in some ways was kind of the inspiration for the whole project, was the first ever automotive periodical in the English language was published in New York, and it was titled The Horseless Age.
Wow, it's a great title.
It's a brilliant title, and it's kind of this idea that, you know, the future is not only going to be full of cars, it's going to be absent of animals. Yeah. And that's going to reflect positively on human society, basically. And they've published an article in 1905 that was talking about how the motor car has reclaimed the road for the American people. kind of complaining about how, you know, the road obviously in American culture kind of, you know, the mythology of it goes back, you know, like decades before that. And you talk about Huck Finn and you talk about the famous poets of this kind of thing. And they're saying that in train journeys, we've been forced to kind of abandon the road, and the road has not been made for the individual, basically, but then the motor car reclaims the road for American society. So you've got this idea of the car kind of being imagined as part of Americanness, basically. And that's kind of what these first road narratives look at, basically. It's how the car sort of starts to become in some ways associated with being American, even though obviously it's a European invention. And so I was looking at these like typically kind of famous American genre, and just, I mean, as I say, that there's much more kind of detailed studies been done on those first famous road narratives, but a lot of them start in 1910, in like the 1910s, when you have, you know, the first coast-to-coast highway completed.
Yeah, sure.
Got the Federal Aid Road Act, so roads start improving massively in quality and like longer journeys become possible. And you kind of have this idea of, well, the car almost taking the place of the horse as kind of, you know, part of like the quest narrative almost. But then when I was rereading these, there's actually quite a lot of animals featured in them, but they're just not, they just get forgotten about, or they just kind of get brushed over.
Yeah.
Or in some cases there's like very significantly in some of these novels. I mean, one of the ones I'm looking at is called We Discover the Old Dominion by a writer called Louise Closser Hale. And there's, you know, this is like a 400 page, very detailed account. And there's pretty much no mention of any animals in it.
Really?
Despite the fact that they're like driving around rural America.
Yeah.
And it kind of got me thinking like, well, yeah, I mean, is there a reason they're being left out? Or is there a reason why they're only included as part of the scenery? And I mean, this kind of contributes to one of the main arguments that I'm making throughout the thesis, which is that automotive culture, and as we kind of move further into the 20th century, the idea becomes it becomes basically positive to think of the car in increasingly dematerialized terms, to sort of, you know, think of it as part of the mythology of the road, you know, part of being American. And you know, kind of animals get swept up in this. You have kind of animal car branding and this sort of thing. And
That's a really good point. Yeah, actually, I've not thought about that.
And I mean, even the word horsepower itself kind of comes slightly dematerialized. Yeah. And what this does is distract from the actual material shortcomings of a reliance on automobiles.
Yeah, I mean, I'm struck by, when you mention that periodical, the kind of mutual exclusivity that it's positing. You know, here's a world with cars that can no longer sustain animals. Is that a tension that exists across all of your primary material? Is it a spectrum? And in some texts, there's a kind of a balance being struck, and in some, it's like the horseless age. It's very much like it's that way. You know, it's the highway or no way kind of thing.
But kind of, yeah. I mean, the thing that actually, like, I was surprised at this myself, to be honest. But the texts I've ended up choosing, they're not kind of all specifically about some kind of like battle between animals and cars. It's kind of a little bit more about the sort of basically what technology comes to mean in terms of human exceptionalism, as we kind of see through various texts, basically. But no, I mean, the great thing about that periodical, The Horseless Age, is that, I mean, it runs from 1895 through to 1919. And then kind of changes its name and gets subsumed by a larger periodical called Automotive Industries after the First World War. And basically, like, throughout its entire publication, it really kind of sets out its stall and then sticks to it, basically, in the saying, like, things like the civilized world says the horse must go, and basically trying to like spread the idea that horses are disappearing and that cars should be seen as a direct substitute for them. And it's very kind of forthright. Yeah. And it makes it very easy to critique, but also to kind of apply to various situations. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's strange, almost like the horse's decline is like a necessary product of modernity or something. That's the kind of mantra that they're pushing.
Totally. And I mean, one of the reasons that I kind of came to this project was I was just reading about, I mean, I can talk more about that in a bit, but just quickly, like, one of the reasons was I was reading an essay by someone who was talking about the horse as being almost a kind of, not the, not the pinnacle of human civilization, but certainly like something that enabled it, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Happened, yeah. And I was just thinking, like, well, if the car replaced the horse, then what does that say about the car's kind of role in creating human civilization at the moment? And what does it mean, you know, that, and we've gone from, you know, basically a sentient animal as kind of, you know, that, I mean, there's problems with them being arguably like enslaved and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, to an inert machine, basically. And there becomes a lot more of a separation between non-human animals and humans as kind of cities become, you know, like dangerous spaces for anyone who isn't a human, basically.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. You think of the horse kind of building civilization, and if the car is replacing that, then the car must be transcendent in some way. Like the car must be kind of the instrument par excellence for the development of humanity. That's what they would have us believe, you know, in modernity and things.
That's the implication, yeah.
Yeah, and like you think of, like, you know, the futurists and stuff, and their manifesto, it's all about, you know, speed. I mean, does that come up in your work at all, kind of?
Yeah, I've mentioned Marinetti a couple of times, yeah, particularly in the chapter about the First World War. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting, I think, that kind of, I mean, that like in Microcosm as well, the title, The Horseless Age, becoming subsumed by automobile industries?
Automotive industries.
Yeah, like that in itself is kind of just like modernity in action in a tiny little example of it, just kind of everything becoming engulfed.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it suddenly becomes, even up till 1919, you know, you have the car being, yeah, so well after Ford started his, you know, automated production line, you still have this idea of the car as a horseless vehicle.
Yeah.
And, you know, and whereas by, you know, sort of after the First World War, as I kind of argue in that chapter, basically the animal basically has no longer has a place. Like, this is an entirely separate thing. And basically any kind of legacy that the horse might still have had in civilization kind of gets shown to be, well, yeah, it gets tragically... Yeah, but yeah, the First World War doesn't do it any favours, and all this kind of old, slightly old-fashioned, perhaps naive, heroic imagery, it becomes much more difficult to apply that.
For sure. I mean, this might be a really reductive question, so feel free to just bat it away or correct me in any way, but, you know, I'm thinking of, like, the kind of classic... you know, indigenous peoples referring to, like, the train as, like, the iron horse, that kind of thing. Like, how does... I guess, like, native perceptions of these technological changes, does that factor into any of the texts at all? Or, I don't know, that kind of, you know, you touched upon it with, you know, how horsepower is still used in kind of modern context. Just thinking, are there any other examples of that kind of hybridizing of the two things that's come up at any point? I mean, it might be a question that's unfair that you haven't looked at, or indeed you have, I don't know.
That's literally the chapter I've just finished writing. So
oh, that's wonderful.
I'm glad you brought that up, yeah. So, I mean, basically there's a lot of racism, as you can imagine, in a periodical like The Horseless Age. A lot of it just kind of, it's not like quite as nationalistic as a lot of periodicals then. I mean, you have like blatant racism in like the New York Times and stuff, for example, as well. I'm not, The Horseless Age isn't like a specifically racist one, but I mean, it makes it quite, you know, that whilst reading it, you definitely get the impression that there's a kind of idea of, when it says the civilized world says the horse must go, you know, it's talking about kind of like white urban Americans, basically.
Yeah, for sure.
Native Americans, as still happens today in automotive advertising, kind of become slightly fetishized almost as animal objects themselves. So when people go on automobile tours, for example, in the 1910s, like a very good way of advertising this in the horseless age would be to point out kind of this contact with the primitive that you can have from the safety of your automobile, for example. But in my chapter, so I'm looking at texts written by Native Americans, including John Joseph Matthews, his novel Sundown, and basically looking at this kind of interplay between modernity and sort of an idea of what it was to be. I mean, John Joseph Matthews is of Osage heritage in Oklahoma. So kind of looking at how cars kind of feature in that society. And there's a book that I'm using called Indians in Unexpected Places by Philip Deloria, who kind of argues that, like, the sight of like Native Americans driving cars, specifically earlier in the century, was very jarring for this idea.
And othered in some way, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And the whole point of kind of, even from like, you know, the 1920s, I think you have the Geronimo Motor Company start. So it's like, you know, Indians already being kind of fetishized in this way as a sort of like escape to the primitive, basically, that the automobile supposedly enables. But kind of by I'm hoping that by looking at this from a kind of perspective of a Native American text, which shows, which features Native Americans using automobiles and engaging with technology, that you can sort of see basically that obviously a lot of the fallacies of periodicals like The Horseless Age and this kind of racism.
Yeah, it's fascinating just how many kind of facets of American culture, you know, racism being one here, like that this project touches, I guess, because it's looking at something, you know, that seems specific at first, but then when it kind of broadens out, you realize it's part of the modern revolution of America. And I guess that kind of, you know, multiple tangents it goes on is what I wanted to ask about my next question, which is quite a broad one, really. So take it however you will. But like, I think like my research as well, you seem to be synthesizing a lot of material. You know, you're looking at authors, you're looking at periodicals. There's a lot of primary material. And this is a problem I've had because I've got so much primary material. And I'm like, how do I make this work? How do I justify comparing different media? You know, there's a graveyard of Word documents on my computer of things I've had to take out that I maybe want to put back in again. So how have you found just synthesizing so much primary material, really? How has the challenge been?
Really difficult. This is the short answer to that, yeah. I think, well, in a slightly, and I mean, this is not something I'd ever advise anyone doing, just thinking about doing a PhD, but I mean, I basically came to this without any knowledge of the primary texts I was going to use, and I didn't really know anything about the period either. Yeah. I just had an idea, and I had this periodical that I'd found, and I was like, this seems important.
Yeah.
Somehow. I'm kind of just going to do this chapter by chapter and see what I can find, pretty much, which is why, I mean, I have a mixture of like very or fairly well-established American authors, you know, such as like, for example, Upton Sinclair and Dreiser. And then like a lot of my chapters are made up of completely unknown authors and completely new even to me. Basically I've kind of just been, well, I've had faith with The Horseless Age throughout as basically this is something which in itself is interesting enough to write quite a lot about.
So it was kind of the root text almost.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know if it's an over-reliance upon it. I hope not, but there's really not been very much written about this periodical at all anywhere.
Yeah.
The point where, the founder and editor's name is always featured as E.P. Ingersoll. And I couldn't find a single reference anywhere, basically, as to what this name meant. I had to get in touch with the Henry Ford archives in America, who found his obituary in the school newsletter from like the college that he went to.
Wow.
Yes.
It's one hell of a paper trail. I mean, what was that like, finding that out?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, all of this is under the, you know, I'm not going to get my tiny violin out, but I was supposed to have like a 5-week research trip in America last year.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask about that. So by all means, do get your violin out.
Yeah. I mean, that would have been amazing. That would have included, working with the Henry Ford archives. It would have, worked with the archive where the actual physical Horseless Age copies kind of are, as well as going to a Native American literature library in Amherst. So basically I did have to kind of slightly change. I mean, that would have all been for the chapter that I've just finished writing, basically. Mm. So, you know, I've got over it research wise. I do feel like I've been robbed of my research holiday, as it were.
Yeah. No, I completely get that. I completely get that. I mean, it's coming from someone who's literally never been to America, and yet for the last, you know, 7 years or whatever, has written every essay at higher education on American culture. It is kind of bizarre. Yeah, so I completely empathize with that. And, you know, I'll ask you a little bit later on about how you've kind of handled things in the pandemic. But obviously that is all or part.
When I started this project, I mean, I can now, but I mean, I couldn't even drive. I'd never ridden a horse. I'd never been to America. And so people used to ask me at conferences about all of these things. And I was like, I don't really feel like I'm an authority on any of those practically. But yeah.
I thought you were about to tell me you can do all three things now. Like, oh, no. You can ride a horse now like it's nothing. Is that on your bucket list to learn, perhaps?
You know what? It actually is now. I wouldn't have said that for a while ago.
Really? That's so good. I mean, one thing I wanted to ask, and I kind of asked other people that have been on before, is, you know, you're in your third year, presumably, you know, what comes next is anyone's guess at this point with how things are. But have you kind of conceptualized any future projects or maybe a trajectory that this project could go on? Because, I mean, recently I've started trying to think about where, you know, what else could I do with this? You know, do I move, take the period that I've used, that kind of chunk of 30 years, and just go up 30 years and, you know, see how things progress? I mean, how have you kind of thought about the future of this project or any other projects that are maybe adjacent?
Honestly, this is taking up all of my headspace at the moment. I haven't really been conceiving of any like future projects. I mean, to be honest, the one thing that's kind of kept me going throughout this, I mean, there've been quite a few books published with similar titles to what I'm doing, but there isn't really much out there, you know, looking at this exact kind of scenario, basically. So, I mean, I'd love to kind of have an opportunity to, you know, grow the project post PhD. There's quite a lot of things I'd do differently. There's quite a lot of things I could do better with proper research and kind of coming at it from a third year perspective, basically, mm-hmm. and beyond. But I mean, you know, at the moment, I'm basically just kind of focusing on finishing it in my now quite narrow time limit of funding.
Yeah.
And basically, I'm just going to kind of have to hit the ground running when it finishes. I don't know if that's a very satisfactory answer.
But no, it absolutely is, because I think that in your position, that's the exact kind of answer I would be giving. I mean, when are you kind of looking to hand in? Do you have a rough idea of when you hope to be finished by? Because, I mean, I guess my own experience, I'm hoping to hand in around September. So the walls really are closing in at the moment. And I'm thinking, how am I going to enjoy summer when it's basically going to have to be dedicated to this? So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would have been certainly looking at before the end of this calendar year. I had a leave of absence about a month ago, which has basically meant that I now have until sort of mid to late January before my funding runs out.
Okay.
But I don't want to be going too far over that limit, to be honest. Yeah.
So. Yeah. Well, I think once you've been going at it this long, you kind of just want to cross the finish line, don't you, Rob?
Do you know what? I mean, like, I'm really not, and I'm very fortunate in this sense, I'm really not sick of the project in any way. But now you get to a certain point where kind of like the word count starts looking a bit less terrifying, and you start kind of thinking seriously about, you know, finishing it, basically. And it's quite exciting, but I just know it's going to be one of those things where it's going to build up to the hand-in point. I'm going to hand it in,
yep.
and then really wish that I could still carry on doing it.
Yeah, the amount of people I've seen just say what an anti-climax it is, because it is like, you know, this huge project of 3 years that you're handing in, and then suddenly you're like, well, what do I do now? You know, this was my passion for 3 years. And, you know, I'm in a similar position to you that I still love the project I'm doing. And fundamentally, you know, advice to anyone listening to this who, you know, hasn't maybe started a PhD yet or is thinking about doing it, that is the one thing that you need, the one fire you need to keep lit, I think. Just love the project you're doing and everything else will follow. I just think that's the best advice. And I mean, it's great to hear that that's, you know, how you fared with your project, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's had its ups and downs, and particularly parts like between writing, I've been sort of, you know, not just not knowing where to go next, but overall it has been fun. For sure.
You mentioned briefly in our kind of email correspondence about a research center, research group that you've kind of network, if you will, that you've set up. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this and feel free to plug away?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can't claim to have set it up, but it was the Sheffield Animal Research Center, or
okay.
It existed long before I.
Oh, right. Okay. That's
basically, the funny thing is that while I was doing my MA, I was completely oblivious that Sheffield was one of the kind of centres in England for animal studies within the humanities.
Right.
There's the founders of people from, you know, politics, English, drama, history, this sort of thing, and kind of just exploring basically, yeah. So the relationships between humans and other animals within the humanities. It's been so great, actually. Like, there's kind of been a reading group that's introduced me to a lot of the, like, foundational kind of texts in a subject that I didn't know anything about at all.
Yeah, yeah.
When I say I came at this PhD, you know, I mean, I know everyone kind of, there's an element of bluff on their application forms, but I really feel like I kind of,
yeah. I'm so with you.
Yeah, it was definitely idea first and then any kind of substance later. But that's been great for kind of almost catching me up on things that I feel I perhaps missed a little bit. And obviously, we publish a blog kind of every month, which just basically enables anyone from within the kind of group to basically just like 1,000-word excerpts of what they're working on, which is really useful, actually, because it's good to kind of keep up with everyone else. They're short enough that, you know, you don't have to spend a long time reading them.
And, yeah, you can digest them in one sitting kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been nice to have a little kind of outlet in that sense. Like, you know, if you're due to publish on the blog, you kind of have to get your ducks in order, as it were, and just kind of just type up whatever you're thinking about. So,
no, that's great. That's great. We're kind of getting towards the end of things now, and I kind of ask everyone who comes on, because of the context of the world we're living in, you know, how has the last year or so been for you, kind of just on a day-to-day basis? How has your process changed, your routine changed? You know, I know personally, I was going to campus a couple of days a week. That's obviously stopped. Now it's just working from home. Now I just change the room I'm working in to try and give myself, like, you know, a bit of a dopamine kick. Obviously, there was the trip to America that didn't come to fruition, unfortunately. So, yeah, just what's changed for you, and how have you kind of negotiated any issues that have come up, if any?
Well, I mean, everything's changed about how I've had to work, basically. I mean, I used to be the kind of person that I used to love. I mean, I'd be in my desk space. I don't want to pretend I was in 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, but that was the idea.
Yeah.
Kind of leave the house, do all of my work, stay there.
Separate work and home.
Totally. And then I try to never do any work on the weekends, and
big just time, yeah.
Keep the same working schedule as my partner, who's a primary school teacher, as much as possible, basically. But yeah, obviously that's all had to completely change. I've had to kind of take over the spare room in our house. It's strange being kind of, I don't want to, you know, I know everyone's had this, and I'm fortunate enough to live with someone else. But I mean, certainly I've spent most of the time Monday to Friday just on my own, just with our little house rabbit. But it has been a very big change, basically. Yeah. I'm just trying to think of anything else. Yeah.
No. That was a really kind of nice, honest appraisal of what your process has been like. It sounds very familiar to a lot of people listening, I'm sure, and to me as well. And, you know, I've gotten a lot out of, I know everyone's so Zoom fatigued at this point. I mean, I certainly am one of them. And, you know, here we are talking on Zoom right now. But the creation of, you know, various digital spaces has really helped me personally, I think. And just, I don't know, I feel far more in tune and aware of the American Studies, you know, network of PhDs than I ever did in my first or second year. And I think maybe that's to do with Twitter. You know, I mention this every episode of USSO cast that we do. I mean, I spend a disgusting amount of time on Twitter. It's terrible for me in the worst possible way. I mean, you see the crap I post. But it has been really beneficial in just creating this feeling of a digital community. And yeah, I wonder if that's something you noticed and have benefited from in any way.
It is, actually, yeah. I mean, I kind of reluctantly came onto Twitter when I started my PhD, just because one of my friends in the year above had kind of given the same advice, basically. They'd said, you know, you can be as skeptical as you want, but I find out about a lot of, you know, call for papers on here and that.
Yeah, same.
Like, well,
yeah.
Okay, that can be the social media thing I just use for work. And that's obviously completely gone out the window as like
it gets its paws into you.
Yeah, that's like every post now seems to be accompanied by a photo of my rabbit. And my dad always likes all of my kind of weird academic posts, and he's basically an online Twitter troll. Yeah, so it looks bizarre. Has any one person liked your post about the paper you're giving, and their name is Cheese Analytica? Yes.
I love that. Well, I think on that note, on Cheese Analytica, I can say thank you so much for joining us, Danny, today. It's been really wonderful to talk to you and to hear about your research. No, I should say, Oh, no, thank you so much. I should say, if anyone listening wants to get involved with USSO Cast, you can email us USSO@BASS, which is BASS.ac.uk, and we'd be very happy to have you on. But yes, thank you very much for listening.